Today in Studio 360.
Why have you been ineffectually pursuing Cheney?
He shot and killed a state senator named Bibbs in Waco, Texas.
Matt Damon. He's one of the stars of the new Coen Brothers movie True Grit, but he has mixed feelings about stardom.
I remember somebody telling me fame is something that you enjoy for a week. And I remember thinking, I didn't even get my week.
Another fictional hunky 40-ish movie star struggling with fame. He's the main character in Sofia Coppola's new movie, Somewhere. But unlike Matt Damon, this fictional movie star seems to be heading nowhere.
I thought about this guy in his Ferrari and he'd have to go to a track in the middle of nowhere. And I thought it would be a visual way to set up the state of his life going around in circles.
And also, rewriting Mark Twain. I'll talk with an English professor who has edited The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn to make it safe for young readers. And he's catching all kinds of hell. I mean heck. That's ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, dedicated to freedom of expression, nurturing creativity, and encouraging originality. Individualism reigns at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, I'll talk to the actor Matt Damon. In True Grit, he gets to show off his comedy chops playing a Texas Ranger who is not your standard action hero.
It was really fun. I mean, the guy's a total windbag.
That's right. I'm a Texas Ranger.
First, though, a story I've been riveted by all week long. I'm not easily riled, but I was really taken aback to hear about a crucially edited new version of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. It will try to solve the novel's, quote, N-word problem once and for all, and that's the end of the euphemism, so be advised. This edition of Huck Finn will replace the novel's 219 instances of the word nigger with the word slave. The perpetrator of this politically corrected version is Professor Alan Gribben, a Twain scholar who teaches English at Auburn University in Alabama. He's had the idea of doing this since his own daughter was being taught the book in school some years back.
Well, I think it's interesting that that school district, as I understand it, no longer teaches Huckleberry Finn, but this was 9.5 years ago. And yes, my daughter had a good African-American friend who confided to her that she literally found the required reading of Huckleberry Finn to be a sickening and disgusting experience to her, and it really turned her off from reading anything else by Twain. That stuck with me. It stuck in my memory, and it bothered my daughter because her you know, her father had made a career of studying Mark Twain.
And that's what is sort of surprising to me. I wonder, you've had this long, distinguished life as a Twain scholar. Do you worry that you're now going to be known as that guy who bowdlerized Huckleberry Finn?
Well, it's a chance one takes, but I certainly feel I'm doing him a favor in one respect. I'm enlarging his audience.
Yes.
And therefore, I make no apology about this. I'm celebrating and giving greater access to the author I have respected and admired and studied all my life.
At the beginning of the 20th century, when a library had its own objections to Huckleberry Finn and threw it out, he said, censorship is telling a man he can't have steak because a baby can't chew it. I guess what you're doing here is cutting up the steak for the babies.
Well, I don't see it that way. The book is much larger than the word. The book has tremendous stories in it, and the word has gotten in the way. Twain could not prophesy such a changed cultural climate as we have today, nor the completely integrated public school systems we enjoy today.
Right.
Twain could only write for his own time, and he didn't have to worry about people's feelings then. We're in a completely changed society today.
It's ironic that the book has been so widely banished from libraries and schools. in an age, as you say, this culturally changed age, part of that cultural change is that in the music that young people listen to, the word nigger appears frequently, more frequently than ever in my lifetime, in the pop culture at large. And yet, in this other part of the culture, we have to say, no, that can't even be uttered or printed in a work of literature.
Well, I find it offensive, and the family I grew up in never used it, and I remember my mother telling me, if you ever hear that word, you'll know you're running around with the wrong kind of people.
No, absolutely.
I think various rap and hip-hop artists might be trying to appropriate and take the sting out of the word by turning around and using it themselves. That's what I assume you're referring to.
Yes.
But I don't find that to be the equivalent of compulsory reading in public schools.
But isn't it? It seems to me that yes, it's uncomfortable to read in mixed race classes of kids, no doubt. But isn't discomfort perhaps part of reading history and learning about all of the ugliness that has existed?
That would be the view of the people who object to this. They see it as a good astringent that should be rinsed thoroughly in everyone's mouth, and you should confront the racism of the society and so forth. But the novel gets at that in many other ways, which are left utterly intact in the book. This is not a colorblind edition of Huckleberry Finn by any means.
Right. This year is, of course, the 150th anniversary of the Confederate secession, and there's going to be a lot of conversation about to what degree we are whitewashing that history or whatever. I wonder if this isn't, in fact, arguably a part of a dangerous revisionism of American history.
Well, as I thought about it more and more, as I had these experiences on my lecture tour, it began to seem to me that we were handicapping teachers and younger readers by not making something available that simply sidestepped this whole controversy about this one word.
And do people ever object to that?
No. I noticed in every case the audience would let out an almost audible sigh of relief, as though I had resolve some problem that they came to the reading with, and they looked very relieved that it was going to be handled this way. Just get rid of the word, and then you can start talking about the story and the beauties and the sharp social critique in these words. I haven't changed any satiric descriptions and his cutting little insights. I've changed one word.
Auburn University professor Alan Gribben. I get his and New South Books' good intentions with their new Adventure of Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer, but it's one more thing that makes me agree with what Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell said the other day after they postponed a big NFL game because of a snowstorm.
Look, this is part of the wussification of America. We used to be a country that had a great pioneer spirit, a sense of adventure, a sense of courage that we could do anything.
Like Huck, Finn, and Jim going up the Mississippi River. Our next story is about a girl who's the furthest thing from a wuss. She's the same age as Huck Finn, on her own in the Old West, and looking for justice with somebody who's got true grit.
I will not go back, not without Chaney, dead or alive.
In the Coen brothers' remake of True Grit, Matt Damon plays a Texas Ranger named LaBeef.
Are you some kind of law?
That's right. I'm a Texas Ranger.
He's on the hunt for a killer, and in this scene, early in the film, he meets the 14-year-old Mattie, hell-bent on avenging her father's murder.
Why have you been ineffectually pursuing Janie?
He shot and killed a state senator named Bibbs in Waco, Texas. Bibbs' family put out a reward. You know anything about the whereabouts of Janie?
Well, he's in the territory, and I hold out little hope for you winning your bounty.
Why is that?
My man will beat you to it. I've hired a deputy marshal, the toughest one they have.
Well, I will throw in with you and your marshal.
No. Marshal Cogburn and I are fine.
It'll be to our mutual advantage. Your marshal, I presume, knows the territory. I know Cheney.
That's Matt Damon in True Grit playing the Texas Ranger LaBeef with his amazing 13-year-old co-star, Haley Steinfeld.
Yeah, you said it. She is amazing. And in the original film, you know, Kim Darby did it, and she was in her 20s. There's a level of confidence that she has that isn't annoying, that isn't, you know, off-putting at all. It's just she's completely in herself, and she looks you in the eye, and she, you know, you just see from the trailer of the film, you know, she says, "My name is Maddie Ross," and the way she says it and just looks right at Jeff Bridges, it's just weird. It's something that I don't know how a 13-year-old does that. I have a 12-year-old.
You know? I mean, no, she's like a prodigy.
She is a prodigy. Yeah. I think that's what a prodigy is, I guess.
Yeah.
I
you played one once of a different sort.
Yeah. I mean, I was 26 when I played that role and still struggled my way through it.
Yeah. Your LaBeef character is this straight arrow sort of nincompoop.
Right.
who exists kind of as a foil to Rooster Cogburn, the Jeff Bridges character, who really gets to chew the scenery for 2 hours. Let's listen to a clip of you arguing with Cogburn, who only has one eye, about who's the better shot.
Mr. LaBeef has a point, Marshal. It is an unfair leg up in any competition to shoot your opposite number.
Damn it, I do not accept it as a given that I did shoot LaBeef. There are plenty of guns going off.
I heard the rifle, and I felt the ball. You missed your shot, Cogburn.
Missed my shot?
You are more handicapped without the eye than I without the arm.
I can hit a gnat's eye at 90 yards. That counterman is running them cheap shells on me again.
I thought you were going to say the sun was in your eyes. That is to say, your eye.
Now, how did you figure out how to do that role?
Well, it was really fun. I mean, I you know, he's the guy's a total windbag. And so, you know, when I met Ethan and Joel about it, you know, it was clear they gave me the book, first of all, and said, instead of a remake, what we're really doing is we want to do a faithful adaptation of this book, and our default setting is classical. And then there was this next phase where they gave us the storyboards. So before we started shooting, we had a book, like a giant comic book, basically, that you could leaf through, and you could see the shot design. Okay, is it a two shot? Is the camera moving?
That sounds incredibly useful. Why doesn't everyone do that?
Well, no, not everybody can, is the truth. And you know, there's none of the kind of kick, bollock, and scramble you get with a normal.
Let's try it this way.
Yeah, there's none of that. And the actors all know what movie they're in. You know, it's not like theater where you're in the same place and the audience is in the same place.
Like most movies, presumably, where you're just guessing what the shot is going to be.
Right, exactly. You're adjusting your performance based on where you are in the frame because your job is different depending on how much of that frame you're meant to occupy.
Westerns, by the time you were growing up, were almost dead as a Hollywood genre. Did you like Westerns? Was a Western something you wanted to do as an actor?
Sure, yeah. I was... I always wanted to do one, and in fact, did a few that nobody saw. You know, I did one in 1993, Geronimo, which were people in my family.
Well, that was before Goodwill Hunting?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Wow.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the Goodwill Hunting, we became overnight successes after we'd been in the union for 10 years.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
But in part because I was doing that movie Geronimo, which, you know, I was told by everybody in L.A., you really need to stay around L.A. because this thing's going to be huge and you got to be ready to go to work.
And then did you wait, as a friend of mine says every time he publishes a book, through the calm before the calm?
Yeah, it was the calm before the less than calm. I mean, it was just unbelievable. You know, I came out over Christmas and I remember kind of going back to Boston in January and people saying, when's your movie coming out?
Nice.
It's like it's already gone.
And then when Goodwill Hunting happened, did you think, okay, finally good. Now I will have the enormous career that I deserved and all the rest of the acclaim and success that came and Oscars and the rest. Just, yeah, okay, this is the time for this now.
I don't know. I think Good Will Hunting, we started writing it. Ben was 20 and I was 22. And it came out when he was 25 and I was 27.
This is Ben Affleck, co-star and co-writer.
And it represented at that time such a huge part of our adult life. It was really basically all of our adult life had been spent on this one project. So
a lot was writing on that.
Everything. And also, I just remember that time as being confusing in some ways. I felt relieved in a lot of ways that we'd been able to even make it. And then when it did so well. But then it was all mixed up with becoming famous and becoming famous fast. And I remember somebody telling me that, you know, fame is something that you enjoy for a week. And I remember thinking, you know, about a month into it, I didn't even get my week.
Yeah. In other roles you've done, the ones I know about, unlike some of them that I evidently don't, like Courage Under Fire, you lost some huge amount of weight to play a junkie. And in The Rainmaker, you became a bartender in Tennessee to get the accent right, I guess, and the attitude. Do you tend to do sort of extreme research things to prepare?
I try to. Just to try to soak up whatever I can. I find that stuff really helpful. And sometimes really great stuff happens. We were just shooting last week in Chicago, and I had to do a scene where I'm in the emergency room. I've brought my wife in, and she dies. And Steven Soderbergh was shooting it, and Scott Burns wrote the script, a terrific script. He wrote The Informant also. And we're all on set, and I said, well, what are we going to do? Are we going to do the slump down the hallway, the wide shot? I mean, How do we do this? And Scott had been in contact with an ER doctor. He was on the set, and he came over, and he had had this conversation literally hundreds of times. And so we started talking about what's an interesting but real way that this might go down. And there's a whole kind of script that the doctor goes off in a way that the doctor has to explain as explicitly as possible.
To tether them to the reality.
To say, you know, she did die. You know, it's you know, and then her heart did stop and she did die. And I'm on the other side. It's going, okay. So can I go talk to her? But again, that's stuff that if you're just making it up, you know, you never get that.
Based on all the TV shows and movies you've ever seen.
Right. And based on your guess of how it might go, you don't get some of that really great stuff.
In Saving Private Ryan, in which you play Private James Francis Ryan, who's the person the Army is trying to find, I still remember this scene. People think of that opening scene on the Normandy beach, but I think of the scene of Tom Hanks's character with you just before the final combat, and I want to play it to remind people of that moment.
Now when I think of home, I think of something specific. I think of my hammock in the backyard, my wife pruning the rose bushes, and a pair of my old work gloves.
This one night, two of my brothers came and woke me up in the middle of the night. And they said they had a surprise for me. So they took me to the barn up into the loft, and there was my oldest brother, Dan, with Alice Jardine. I mean, picture a girl who just took a nosedive from the ugly tree and hit every branch coming down. and Dan's got her shirt up. So he's working on this bra and he's trying to get it off, and all of a sudden John just screams out, "Danny, you're a young man, don't do it." And so Alice Jardine hears this, and she screams, and she jumps up, and she tries to get running out of the barn, but she's still got this shirt over her head. She goes running right into the wall and knocks herself out. So now Dan is just so mad at us. He starts coming after us. But at the same time, Alice is over there unconscious. He's got to wake her up. So he grabs her by a leg, and he's dragging her. At the same time, he picks up a shovel, and he's going after Sean. And Sean's saying, "What are you trying to hit me for? I just did you a favor." And so this makes Dan more angry. He tries to swing this thing. He loses the shovel, goes out of his grasp, it hits a kerosene lantern. The thing explodes. The whole barn almost goes up because of this thing. That was it. That was the last. That was. Dan went off to basic the next day. That was the last night the four of us were together. That was 2 years ago.
Ah, misogyny.
but a beautiful, old-fashioned heartland misogyny. Saving Private Ryan, Matt Damon. That to me, that scene, beautifully written, but kind of justified your entire existence in that film, almost.
Well, that's an interesting thing about that scene was that monologue that I did, by the time we shot Tom's side, Tom had heard the thing 35 times. And so that's not how it was written. What I said there was I made it up, just literally to get a reaction from Tom.
Really?
Just to do him the favor of being so he could hear a story for the first time, you know, that he could kind of enjoy. And, you know, we had taken so long on my side that we were losing the light. And so Tom probably only got two takes, which is probably all Tom needed. But Steven enjoyed that story being told that way so much that he came marching up and he said, "We're coming back here first thing in the morning and we're shooting your side, you know, with those
because
lines."
You had done it unintentionally more authentically than you'd done it before?
I'm sure that I probably, because I was making it up and using my own words, that I connected
it
to it
sounded totally
better.
Real.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. And so Steven let me do it again. So it's interesting. I hadn't heard that since the movie came out. I hadn't heard that.
You have played an incredibly diverse role of characters. Action hero Jason Bourne, you the bumbling thief Linus in the Ocean's movies, this schlumpy, earnest, complicated, confused corporate manager in The Informant. Is there a kind of career management strategy here of I'm gonna avoid being typecast by playing such different kinds of people movie to movie?
No. I think, you know, if anything has guided me or my decision making, it's just been about the directors. You know, I figured out pretty quickly that, you know, an average director can make a great script average, and a great director can make an average script into a great movie.
And I'll get your list of those, too, later.
Yeah, I mean, and also I'm not afraid to take a smaller role.
Right.
And I feel like everybody wins in a good movie.
Yeah. Was there a moment when you were a kid growing up, a play you saw or a book you read or a movie you saw where you said, I want to do something like that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll say one that I'm sure every kid my age probably said was Star Wars. But I do remember walking to the movie theater with my brother again and again and again.
You were the perfect 7-year-old.
That's right.
Demo.
That's right. I was right in the slot, and my brother was 10, and we saw it over 20 times. And because to a 7-year-old, the idea that you could be transported to a galaxy far, far away. I mean, it literally blew my mind,
yes.
You know?
No, and people forget what an amazing advance just visually that film was when it came out 33 years ago.
It's funny. When Avatar came out, my brother called me and was laughing, and he said Miles, his younger son, he said has found his Star Wars. He said he looks just like I imagine we looked, you know, when we would, and he can't stop talking about it. He says it's the best movie that's ever been made, you know? And it's just that that's what movies can do.
Matt Damon, thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Kurt. Appreciate it.
Matt Damon is one of the stars of True Grit, which is in theaters everywhere. Coming up, some more gritty truth. In the 21st century, artists are discovering Detroit's 20th century urban ruins.
I thought, okay, there's going to be a lot of old, late 19th century mansions that are all tumbled down and boarded up. But what I didn't expect was to see libraries, churches, hospitals, you know, all kinds of factories.
And some Detroit locals aren't totally happy about the attention. We'll hear from them ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. I want to go home. I want to go home. Oh, how I want to go home.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion offers options that let everyone express his or her creativity to customize their car to fit their lives. Creativity begins at Scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
General Motors confirmed it today. It is going to close plants employing almost 30,000 workers.
The effect on Flint is absolutely devastating.
That is from Michael Moore's 1989 documentary Roger and Me, about the people just getting by in Detroit and Flint, Michigan, as the U.S. auto industry seriously began its decline. 2 decades later, Detroit is deeper in disrepair, and that's made it irresistible to certain kinds of artists and photographers from around the world. For the last few years, they've been coming in to document the crumbling architecture and ghost city streets. There's a name for this kind of work, ruin porn. We sent Michigan Radio's Jennifer Guerra to find out how Detroit is handling this new identity as America's capital of urban ruins.
In Detroit, the city's decay can only be described as overwhelming. Everywhere you look, abandoned buildings litter the skyline.
Detroit has the greatest collection of Depression-era architecture in the United States.
Dan Austin is obsessed with these buildings. He's a copy editor at the Detroit Free Press by day, but at night, he's home at his computer posting all kinds of information and pictures to his website called Buildings of Detroit. The website is now a book called Lost Detroit.
We have people email us all the time from France, and had one a couple days ago from Sweden. It's like, I want to come to Detroit and shoot photos of your architecture. Can you help me? So, I mean, I don't really have a problem with it. I mean, some people think it's a negative, but on one hand, anything that brings people into the city of Detroit is a plus.
And he says, hands down, the first place everyone wants to visit?
Oh, Michigan Central, beyond, I mean, no question. Undisputed champion of architectural ruin porn.
The Michigan Central train station was built in 1913 by the same guys who designed Grand Central Station in New York. The building is massive. You can see it from the freeway. All the windows busted out, spray paint everywhere, trees growing out from the top of the depot. People sometimes compare it to the Colosseum in Rome. It's a giant ruin in the heart of a city. And almost every day, people are there taking pictures, like the photographer Andrew Moore, who's from New York City.
Well, I mean, you know, it's the kind of thing I've been doing for a long time.
For his new book, Detroit Disassembled, Moore hit all the ruin porn biggies in the city. Michigan Central, the Packard plant, the city's old technical high school.
I think there is a long sort of artistic tradition of photographing ruin as a way of sort of talking about, you know, man's life. And there's a kind of mortality involved. And just as we look at an old face and see somebody's life, you can look at an old building that's, you know, certainly past its prime and get a sense of history. As you know, and these places are witnesses to history and an important history.
Moore spent 60 days in Detroit photographing the ruins. Urban explorers took him into the notorious Detroit Public Schools book depository, where thousands of books are moldering in piles on the floor. He photographed the crumbling concert venue where Detroit punk rockers the MC5 used to play to crowds of screaming teenagers. You have one picture where you can only see the tip-top of a two-story house that's just covered in trees and green and moss. I mean, were you expecting to find that?
No, I had a set of expectations. I thought, okay, there's going to be a lot of old, late 19th century mansions that are all tumbled down and boarded up and sloping. But what I didn't expect was to see libraries, churches, hospitals, all kinds of factories, manufacturing center, so forth. Just the variety of things that had fallen. We're kind of falling apart, and in a very dramatic way.
One of the book's most striking images is the Model T headquarters in Highland Park.
There's this extraordinary scene where they're in May, and the entire floor is covered in this bright green carpet of moss. And it has these little ridges in it, almost as like looking at an aerial view of rice paddies in Indonesia. And it's Henry Ford's office from when they built the Model Ts. So it's a powerful image of what was and what's happened to it.
Some Detroit photographers don't really see it that way.
I might not connect to a lot of the photographs that strictly deal with abandonment, but that's just because that's not what I think is most interesting about this city.
That's Roman Blankard. I caught up with him and fellow photographer Brian Wittes at a coffee shop in the city. They both agree that pictures of ruins are important, but
most people don't have the right knowledge of history to look at these pictures and know what they mean. So what happens is that people are going to look at these pictures and their senses are going to get excited for just peeking into a situation that is horrible. And I think that's when the photograph becomes ruin porn.
The two photographers got so fed up a couple years ago with people parachuting in from all over the world to take pictures of the so-called ruins of Detroit, they responded with their own website called Can't Forget the Motor City.
The idea, I think, for us for the project, and there's this one expression my wife said from the beginning, is that under the carcass lays the soul. And that's what we want to explore, is that soul. What do people do here? How do they live in this city that is bombed out in many ways, that is, for many, looks like a war zone?
Instead of buildings, they focus on people. They capture what it's like to walk through the neighborhoods. You'll see a picture of two Mexican teens sitting on a swing, kissing. Brian Wittes told me about another image of people dancing in an abandoned lot.
It's called John's Carpet House. It's this summer blues jam. It's a really positive thing that happens once every week. A couple hundred people come out and they listen to live music and dance and barbecue.
Andrew Moore, the New York photographer, understands where the two Detroit photographers are coming from.
I think if you live there, you're so jaded in some senses to all this decay, dereliction, things falling apart. It's hard to work from it. It's hard to make art from it. So I think as a tourist, as somebody coming with fresh eyes, I mean, you have the advantage of, you know, both horror and awe of this process and in a kind of maybe even an enthusiasm.
And while it might seem like most artists new to town just want a piece of the ruin action before flying back to wherever it was they came from, some, like artist KT Andreski, decide to stay.
I had done some research about what the state of Detroit was in and the art spaces that were already here.
KT left San Francisco for Detroit's east side. It's more than a little rough around the edges there. She hears gunshots regularly. She and some other artists just bought an old cigar factory for $21,000 that they plan to fix up.
Detroit is one of the only places that an artist can come in and own a building with the amount of revenue that they get.
It takes a little while for Andreski's friend, artist Blake Carroll, to unscrew the heavily boarded-up door to their new building. But when we finally get inside...
All right, home sweet home.
The place is completely destroyed. Copper pipes have been stolen, electrical wires.
You basically get the outside walls. I mean, we got a good deal on a bunch of bricks, basically. It needs new windows, the floor's all buckled, water's been coming in. The basement was like the public bathhouse. There's mold.
They want to build a wood shop in there. Also a ceramic studio, a dance floor, retail and office space, even apartments on the top floor.
The name of this space is the World Headquarters. We are all interested in world domination through the arts.
They just started to apply for grants, so renovations and world domination might have to wait a while. Which is okay. Andreski has more than enough to keep her busy. She's got her day job teaching art and urban gardening to Detroit school kids. Plus, there's all the email she and Carol have to go through.
We're getting contacted weekly saying, I'm thinking of coming to Detroit. And it's like, well, yeah, come here and then we'll talk.
And while they won't hold your hand and show you how to parachute into Detroit to get a piece of the ruin action, if you do decide to stay, they'll probably hand you a power tool and put you to work. For Studio 360, I'm Jennifer Guerra.
You can see some of the images talked about in that piece at studio360.org. Even in this slow, sputtering economy, maybe especially now, going green seems to be the hopeful vision for regaining America's business leadership. We met one entrepreneur who's decided to give it a try. It's a one-man operation run by Studio 360's Scott Blazek.
My name is Scott Blazek, and I'm a highly skilled professional assassin. That's right. I kill people for a living. But there's something that sets me apart from my competition. You see, I'm the world's first carbon-neutral assassin. If you're thinking, so what, then I'm afraid you're naive about the business of contract killing. Assassins are by nature environmentally irresponsible. It's a dirty little secret of our industry. All those Aston Martins, first-class flights to Europe, luxury hotel stays,
room service,
they all add up. In fact, the average assassin is responsible for 80 metric tons of CO2 a year. That's why I do things differently. How do I manage my toxic emissions in such a dangerous profession? With energy-saving techniques every step of the way. No high-end sports cars for me, thank you. When I'm on a job, I use buses at peak hours and the occasional mountain bike. Bullets and plastic explosives? How could I live with myself? No, my weapons are cotton fiber ropes, shivs carved from reclaimed wood, or locally grown organic fruit laced with free-range viper venom. And I can't even begin to describe how satisfying it is to take out a guy using only tidal power. I know what you're thinking. Yeah. These days, everybody claims to be carbon conscious. Here's the difference. To protect our planet, I put my life on the line. When I'm figuring out how to sneak into a Russian mobster's chateau, don't you think I'd rather just squeeze off a few high-density sniper rounds from a mile out? But that's not an option, because those tungsten carbide traces would contaminate our soil for generations. Now, let's face it. This is a results-driven business. You don't give a damn about my carbon footprint if at the end of the day your ex-boyfriend is still breathing. I get that. Sure, I may take a little extra satisfaction when I off a Hummer-driving oil executive, but rest assured, I'll slit the throat of the guy who invented solar panels if that's the contract. Instead of ditching the weapon in the sewer, though, I'll wash it with a soy-based soap. Reduce, reuse, recycle. Because when you get right down to it, this planet belongs to all of us, the assassins, the contractors, and the targets. So the next time you're contracting a hit, pay a little extra and hire me, the world's first carbon-neutral assassin. If you don't, you'll just be solving one problem while contributing to another. Thank you for your time.
It's not that easy being
a monologue by Studio 360's Scott Blazek, performed by Mark Price. And let's just be clear, environmentally friendly or otherwise, Studio 360 does not endorse violent crime. Coming up, Hold the Dialogue. The director Sofia Coppola explains her unorthodox approach to interactions on film.
You know, a lot of times in movies people explain all their feelings, but in life, you know, you're not always able to or articulate a lot of things. And part of the fun of making films is telling the story in a visual way.
Sofia Coppola on her new movie, Somewhere. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, dedicated to freedom of expression, nurturing creativity, and encouraging originality. Individualism reigns at Scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Sofia Coppola's Oscar-winning hit Lost in Translation was the charming story of two strangers who meet in a hotel in Tokyo. a listless middle-aged actor, played by Bill Murray, and a listless recent college graduate and newlywed, played by Scarlett Johansson. Coppola's new movie, Somewhere, is a bit of an echo of Lost in Translation. Once again, it's set in a hotel, and it's also about a mopey male movie star and a young blonde. This time, the star is played by Stephen Dorff, but the girl is just 11 years old, the daughter who has suddenly re-entered his life.
Hey, Cleo.
Hey. Why are you taking a bath next door? Is yours broken?
Yeah. Yeah, it's been acting weird. What a nice surprise. Come on in.
Get your stuff.
Shouldn't you be in school today?
It's Sunday.
Sofia Coppola, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
So the character that Stephen Dorff plays, the star of your movie, Johnny Marco, is kind of a pathetic, worthless-seeming cipher to me in his celebrity bubble. Except then we see him be this decent, obviously loving father to this kid, and he's becomes likable. Was that the germ, the intention?
Well, I wanted to start with this guy that's just drifting and kind of tripping through life with lots of random girls and pills and his Ferrari, and he's kind of just out of balance and out of touch with real life. And then spending some time with his 11-year-old daughter kind of wakes him up and reminds him of a part of himself that he lost touch with.
But except for the fact that, he's nice to his kid, we don't see anything else about him. We don't see him reading. We don't see him reacting to people in a particularly revealing way, one way or the other, which isn't, you know, how they tell you to do things in writing 101.
He's very passive, but I think you get what kind of guy he is. But he is passive. He's kind of numb, and he's just letting things happen to him. But I think you get a sense of him that he's not a bad guy. He's polite with the people he interacts with.
And even the strippers he hires, he's perfectly nice too, and not very predatory toward.
Yeah, and he doesn't feel like it, but he gives him a little applause. So I feel like he's a polite guy, but he's just lost touch. And it's true, he's very flawed, and he could be very unlikable. But I think because he's sweet underneath it, hopefully you connect to him.
He's a movie star. We're not sure exactly what kind of movies he makes or what level he is. Did you have a Brad Pitt, a Leo DiCaprio, or some level of stardom in mind for this guy?
Yeah, he was based on a bunch of different kind of movie star actors that I've known or met or heard stories about and mixed them all together. Yeah, I think he's pretty famous. He's become famous recently, and he's doing a press conference in the movie for a movie he's done called Berlin Agenda. So you get the idea that he's kind of done some big action movie that he's not very proud of.
Yeah.
I never want to show him making a movie. It's not really about the film business, but that's the backdrop. And I try to think of things that actors would do, you know, in between films, like get a head plaster cast, or sometimes they learn strange skills. And you hear stories about actors having romances with their leading ladies. And I thought, well, what happens when they have to get back together?
You hear stories. You're in the movie business. You must experience those
stories. Well, I've seen some things. But then I thought, like, what's it like when they have to be together a year later for a reshoot or a press junket?
Yeah.
And, you know, they've been like, I think in Hollywood, they was like get engaged. Everything's heightened when you're doing a movie and then it's over.
Let's listen to a scene. This is where he and his daughter Cleo, played by Elle Fanning, and by the way, Elle Fanning is, as I'm sure you realize, an extraordinary person, a boon to your film.
Yeah, I loved working with her, and I think she brings so much.
Here they are at a film festival. She's eating breakfast in this fancy hotel with Johnny and the woman he just slept with
There's no dialogue in the scene. How do you? I'm curious. Okay.
Well, we'll see.
How old are you, Cleo?
11.
Do you have a boyfriend? When I was 11, I was so in love with this boy, Nino Vitti. He was so handsome. And he had a scooter. Do you like to ride a scooter?
Sure.
Morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
What I love about that scene is the looks between Elle Fanning and Stephen Dorff, because they say so much without any dialogue, but you kind of get the whole thing that she's telling him, get this girl out of here.
You like doing that, right? You like sort of saying, having as little as you can get away with in dialogue and making scenes work.
Yeah, I like, in life how so much is conveyed by the way someone gives a look or a glance. And I think, a lot of times in movies people explain all their feelings, but in life, you know, you're not always able to or articulate a lot of things. And part of the fun of making films is telling the story in a visual way.
It's an entirely visual way. A lot of the times the film begins with Johnny riding his Ferrari around a track that I, because I'm stupid, didn't realize was a track or even the same car until about the third time around.
It's sort of abstract, this image
at
the beginning.
Yeah, but that's really what it is. It is like a piece of video art practically.
Thank you. When I started writing it, I thought about this guy in his Ferrari and he'd have to go out to a track somewhere outside of L.A. in the middle of nowhere to be able to drive it around because you're stuck in traffic in L.A.
Right.
And so I just imagined him going around this track in circles. And, you know, I thought it would be a visual way to set up right away that the state of his life, that he's just kind of going around in circles.
Yeah.
And introduce him that way.
Well, that and the scene where he's this long, involved process of getting his old man makeup.
A head cast made.
I mean, one comes away thinking, among other things, wow, the life of this glamorous superstar is kind of boring and unglamorous.
Yeah, well, I think when you're in any kind of life, there's all the other sides that people don't see that don't seem glamorous. I can't imagine anyone's life feels glamorous to them.
On the inside?
Yeah.
Unless they're taking drugs or something, I guess.
Marie
Antoinette, which I loved, was this big, crazy, stimulating, attitude-filled, incident-packed movie. Maximalist. This is minimalist. The opposite, pretty much. What was making this film a kind of pendulum swing reaction to that?
I think it was definitely a reaction to that. That after, you know, it was just so much decoration and also my girly feminine side. And so I thought after that, I felt like trying to do something from a guy's point of view and do something very sparse and minimal and work with a small, intimate crew.
It's interesting to me that Lost in Translation, your great big hit about a star and his staying in a hotel. This is another movie about a star staying in a hotel, the Chateau Marmont in L.A. What is attractive to you about setting a film in a hotel?
I guess I like the way hotels become this kind of world within themselves, the kind of people that stay there. And because it's not permanent, it makes sense to me for these characters that are sort of in transition in their life.
It adds a sense of drift and unmooredness, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
As we mentioned, Lost in Translation has Bill Murray as this middle-aged actor and Scarlett Johansson who meet at a bar in the hotel and find that they can relate to each other better than their respective significant others. I want to play a clip from that film.
What are you doing?
My husband's a photographer, so he's here working. And I wasn't doing anything, so I came along. And we have some friends that live here.
How long have you been married?
Oh, thank you. 2 years?
25 long ones.
Mm. You're probably just having a midlife crisis. Did you buy a Porsche yet?
You know, I was thinking about buying a Porsche.
That is Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson in Lost in Translation. That scene and that film, like Somewhere as well, requires and expects, I guess, a kind of patience on the part of the audience that movies less and less seem to demand, require, expect. And there's also something, in both of these cases, very low concept. It's a guy and his daughter.
Yeah.
A guy and his, from divorce. These two people who happen to meet. It's not like the Hollywood pitch. And she's has anorexia, and he's a pilot who cures anorexia or anything. Is that your desire to just be more like real life in the films you make?
Yeah, definitely. I think I try to avoid kind of how they would do it in a movie and do it more like life. And I feel like in a movie you'd have to encounter a big disaster or be held hostage or something to motivate a character to change. But I feel like in life...
Die Hard in a Japanese hotel.
Yeah. But I feel like in life there can be little moments that make a big impact and change you, and it doesn't sound like a big deal. And I want to look at those.
And the films you make are relatively inexpensive, a few million rather than many tens of millions of dollars. Is that because that's the way you like to work, or because the kinds of movies you like to make can only work in a business sense at that budget?
Yeah, I think it's both. I try to just keep the budget as small as possible so I can have complete creative freedom. And if I think if it was bigger, I'd have more notes and opinions.
They wouldn't let you start the movie with a car going around in a circle for 5 minutes?
Yeah, and I might have to have a plot.
There you go. Well, more power to you.
Thanks.
Sofia Coppola, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sofia Coppola's new film, Somewhere, is in theaters right now.
10:30 in this hotel room. You and I locked in the gloom. Lost out of love once again. But I've got you here with me, friend, 'cause you're here in my arms. Here in my arms. Here in my arms. Here in my arms.
And that is it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening, either on radio or podcast. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Rob Weisberg, Michael
Guerriero, Max Bass,
Julia Botero,
Georgette Pierre.
And thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
PRI's Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by Scion, dedicated to freedom of expression, nurturing creativity, and encouraging originality. Individualism reigns at Scion.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
25 years ago, Doonesbury creator Gary Trudeau started aging his characters in real time.
It's no easier to make them truly old than it is to look in the mirror and see yourself aging. Every time I add white hair, it's actually a big deal for me.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.